Welcome to SelfDiscoveryWisdom.com, formerly known as Self Discovery Media. On these podcasts, you're going to hear people who speak from the heart. They've taken the journey in life. Many things have happened to them, but they've changed it to happening for them. And in their strength, their courage, they've discovered their abilities and their wisdom, and they are now sharing it here with you. Do enjoy each show. We bring it to you with love and knowing that it's going to help you on your journey of life. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of Raising Our Gifted Children right here on selfdiscoverywisdom.com. I'm your host, Sarah Troy, and my wonderful guest today is Yasmin Helwani. And we're going to be talking about children, one of my favorite subjects. And she says, if I could, I would. Understanding the voice of behavior in the classroom. She says, as a teacher, I believe that every child deserves the opportunity to succeed in the classroom. But it has become increasingly clear to her that some of the students, particularly those with neurodivergence, were facing challenges with their behavior. It wasn't a matter of them being bad or difficult children. Rather, they simply lacked the tools and strategies they needed to navigate the emotions and interactions effectively. By implementing ABA strategies in the classroom, she's witnessed remarkable transformations. Students who once struggled with outbursts and meltdowns learned to regulate their emotions and communicate their needs more effectively. They gained confidence and independence, and their academic and social skills flourished. It's not just about managing their behavior. It's about empowering children to succeed in all aspects of their lives. And that's why she's proud to be both teacher and board certified behavior analyst at Child Care Services, where she can contribute to making a difference into the child and children's lives, especially those with autism. Wonderful work, first and foremost. So thank you so much for coming here and for also doing the work that you're doing. I do believe that by investing in our children, we're investing in our future. They are our future leader. We see so much disconnect among society today, which I believe we can turn the clock back to the way we raise our children. And school systems are out of date with the way they address children, and especially with children that have any what I call differently abledness, because I don't like to put disability, that they're just differently abled and we need to communicate with them in a different way. But teachers aren't being trained, parents aren't being trained, medical system is not being trained, and so a lot of children are falling through the cracks. So thank you for doing what you're doing. First and foremost,
thank you for
welcome
me
to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Sarah. I'm really excited. Like yourself, this is a topic I really enjoy discussing. And I think there's a really big need of conversations like this, just because of what we're seeing in the education system these days and how education has changed over time and what has not changed. So I think this is a really important conversation to have, and I'm really excited to be a part of it and be a part of your show. Thank you.
Well, thank you for being willing to discuss it, because I know that it can be, you know, a challenge for certain people. I was talking about our Forgotten Children book, which I'm going to bring up now, because, you know, had I met you earlier, you would have been in it, but there's always book two. And you know, our Forgotten Children is 15 chapters of people that have either raised children, have children with neurodivergency, or teachers, but people have worked with children and families, and it's all about how we've let them down. We've let the systems let them down. And that when you look at what our children are facing in the future, what are we doing to help them, you know, face that future confidently when we're still trying to teach them and our out-of-date, archaic, you know, teachings, and especially children that have any form of differently abledness, OCD, ADD, dyslexia, never mind autism, Down syndrome, AD, disruptive behavior, which I won't forget the initials on that.
ADHD?
It's actually, I've got it in the book. I'm going to look it up quickly because one of our parents had it in the book here. And it's it's disruptive behavior. And it's one I'd never heard about before, you know, people approach me about the book. And it's children that are just can't cope, have a great deal of meltdowns, get very, very angry. And kind of around 18, they can start, you know, getting better at it. But They're just labeled as bad children, when really what it is, they cannot cope with what's in front of them. We need to give kids and parents a break, don't we?
Yes, yes, we do. It's really, you know, it's really important that you brought that up, because I've noticed in all of the students that I've been working with and all of my clients that I'm a BCBA for, one of the biggest issue that I see across the board is regulation and the ability to regulate emotions. That is just something that I see across the board. And I see oftentimes other teachers and parents getting very frustrated with them, rightfully so, not thinking about what, you know, not understanding that this could possibly be something that they just don't know how to do.
Yes.
And we need to provide the tools to give them so they know how to regulate their emotions.
Exactly. So a whole different learning game, isn't it? It's actually disruptive mood dysregulation disorder. So I've got that. I'm dyslexic, so I always say things the wrong way around. So I'm glad we got that there. We're coming up with things with our children today that, you know, I've interviewed an awful lot of people who have raised autistic children that were let down by the system, and people who are autistic. And what I have found, particularly with many of the people I've interviewed who are autistic, is they're very focused and passionate about something, and they're very focused on the creativity of what they do. They're very selective of the people they have around them, and they like to keep things on a nice harmonious equilibrium, and don't like kind of the static that you can get from either crowds or, you know, other people that of negative energies. In a way, they're actually a great example of how we should live. Is, you know, focus in on something we're passionate about. Be choosy of who's you're around, you know, make sure you're of the same vibe tribe, right?
Mm-hmm.
And don't tolerate people that want to be negative around you. So, you know, I think they're a great beacon of an example to many in many ways.
I completely agree. And I just think, you know, seeing those behaviors, society considers that abnormal, right? And they look at behaviors like that and they say, that's not normal. And once a person has the diagnosis,
yes,
you know, of autism or anything, they tend to kind of put them in a box with
yes,
society that limits their potentials and capabilities, and everyone looks at them differently. And it could affect their, you know, future of getting a job or going to the colleges that they want to go to just because they have that diagnosis. But I tend to kind of take a step back when I'm working with these kids and I'm like, what is normal? You know, what is
yes,
normal?
Exactly. If this dysfunction in the world is normal, who wants it?
Yes. You know, what exactly does normal mean? So that's kind of something I tend to do when I see a behavior that, you know, a behavior in question or behavior that might be not in the, you know, that other people might not be doing, or things that I haven't really seen too often. And I kind of have to take a step back and I'm like, you know what, let me try this out. Let me get
yes,
into their world and let me, see what it's all about. And I think that's the difference, where again, society tends to put them in this box and it limits their capabilities, limits their potential. People look at them differently because of that word, normal.
Yes. Which again, what is normal? And quite honestly, as I said, looking at society today, if this is the norm, we've really got to change the dial on that, because we're seeing a bunch of very angry, disconnected, disharmonious people. And that is not should be the norm in any way. And, you know, again, when you I have a grandson with Down syndrome, and he's 11 months now. And what I've noticed is that when he's upset, he cries. Right? Hungry, this, that, etc. He cries. Once that's done, it's done. He's finished. Right? And then it's all back to smiles. And it's, you know, he's obviously slower in learning. He isn't quite crawling yet. He's trying to get around. He swirls instead. We know that there's going to be certain things that he's going to be slower at developing. But we looked at a child that just simply lives in the moment and lives most of the time in joy. Isn't that a gift? Why are we looking at him as disabled? He's differently able, that's all.
Right, no, it's such a beautiful mindset. And I just think, again, it's like looking at every behavior is a form of communication.
Yes.
And, you know, looking at the crying, and it's their way of telling us something, you know, every behavior. And that's what being a behavior analyst has really taught me, even with my special education students, having that experience has really shaped my understanding of behavior and why kids communicate the way they do. But, you know, there's a point where I had to shift my mindset to take a step back. And, you know, when a kid is crying or having a tantrum or getting upset, I kind of have to take a minute, think about what is the why? Why could they be doing this? Are they hungry? Could it be medically induced? Should it be something that is in the environment? It could be any one of those things, but just kind of taking a step back and saying why instead of being reactive and responding in that moment. And that's, again, what society tends to do. And it's like instinct, I guess, where we're just taught to just be reactive and jump in and just immediately get involved, or instead of taking a step back and just thinking about why this could be happening.
Yeah. There was a great Facebook posting today that somebody took a picture of a father just standing there, hands crossed, while his two-year-old is on the ground having a complete meltdown. And like, it's just saying, it's okay, it'll be over soon. And you cannot reprimand a child or do anything with a child in that time. Okay, obviously, if it's maybe in a public place, in the theater or something, take them out. But, you know, it's that child needs to spend that. And for you to interrupt and punish them or yell at them is only going to exasperate it even more, right? Because they're in a meltdown because they don't know how to cope with what's going on.
Yes, exactly. And I've seen, many times where I'm at the grocery store or I'm at the mall and I see a kid having a meltdown and on the floor and everyone is just staring at them and staring at the parents and looking at the parent like they are terrible.
Yeah, judgment, judgment. Yes. Yeah,
exactly. And it's, you know, there's probably so much more going on than we could ever know. You know, that child could be having a really hard time accepting, maybe denied access or something, and the environment could have triggered them. And again, it's important to take a step back and think of the why instead of jumping to conclusions and being judgmental and, you know, just being more okay with seeing that and watching that happen instead of being so judgmental and, you know, a lot of like judgment towards the parents, and that's not fair.
How about ask the parent, can I do anything for you?
Yes.
Can I help you with your groceries while you're dealing with your child? Or just, you know, pat on the back, I'm there. Is there anything I can do? You know, it's just supportive. Why are we immediately go to, you know, condemning instead of being supportive? What is it about our nature that steps into judgment instead of compassion?
Right. And, you know, oftentimes as a with my BCBA clients, a lot of parents tell me that they don't even want to take their kids to the grocery store or take them on outings, take them to birthday parties because of the fear of embarrassment, the fear of judgment from other people. And that's not fair either.
No, it isn't. You know, the thing about a child when it has a meltdown, we have meltdowns, you know, we have them. And the one thing we've got to remember with our children, no matter what, any challenges they may have, they're sponges. They're going to absorb everything they see around them. And I remember having an animal behaviorist on, and he said, if your dog is playing up, chewing things up, it's not the dog. It's they're picking up the anxiety from you. And the dog is reacting out because it doesn't know what to do with that anxiety. That goes the same for children. If we're uptight or anxious, they're picking it up. Subliminally, they're taking it on that they've caused it, right? If a parent is going to divorce, the first thing the children thinks it's their fault, right? And because they don't know any better. So we have to be very conscious of our own verbiage, our own actions. And, you know, make sure that if whatever these children are sponging off us, is that it's something that's healthy for the child.
That is very true. And I think going along with what you said, another thing that, sorry, I don't know, Siri is okay. another thing going along with what you said is oftentimes people assume that children who are non-speaking or don't have the same amount of language that we do don't understand. Mm. And there's this big assumption that that's true, when in reality is I have worked with many children who are non-speaking or pre-verbal and learning how to talk, who understand exactly what's going on, are very aware of my emotions and everyone else's emotions, and feed off of our energy as well.
Yeah, exactly. I have an ex-brother-in-law that didn't speak until 3 and a half. Then he didn't keep quiet, but he didn't speak until 3 and a half. And, you know, who knows why, you know, and it doesn't mean there's anything wrong. It's just like they'll speak like it's like potty training. They'll potty train when they're ready. You can't bribe them with this. I know many people just do it cold turkey and go through, you know, everything. But, you know, it's like at some point the child's got to decide to want to do it themselves. And that's, it's not just about the choice of the potty training, but it's about giving them a choice, right? Not shaming them because they're still in diapers at three, but giving them a choice that they want to do this and you encourage that, but not forcing them to do something before they're ready and feeling they don't have a voice.
Right, because then we're just setting them up for failure.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we do things with good intentions and we, you know, we don't want to, I mean, I remember my daughter, we did a fashion show. My kids were in the fashion show and it's at the end of the fashion show. We're in the mall. And my daughter was, she was a teenager, well, not quite a teenager, about 9 or 10. And she's in a very loud voice and something about, I was getting cross with her because she was playing up and she was saying something, you always hit me, and kind of in a loud voice where I'm not touching her, right? Like, and everybody just staring at me. And it's like,
oh no.
I mean, she's been the one always to say these things that kind of, you know, put the spotlight on me, blurting things out. And it's, you know, it's like, it is hard as a parent. How do you deal with that when you know that all eyes are on you? What would you suggest for a parent that is suddenly is put into that spotlight?
So it's definitely a tricky situation and it's definitely hard to be in that, you know, situation because again, you're focused on what everyone else could be thinking.
Yeah.
But again, I just think my advice would just be to just do what you would do if nobody else was there, you know, like it, pretend that, you know, everyone else is just not listening and not there and just act natural, be confident and like understand that even though this is a really hard situation, they're kind of put on that spotlight, I would just kind of continue as what they, you know, what they would be doing. And then I would just, you know, if somebody asks, right, in your situation, if somebody, you know, if you're, if somebody heard your daughter say something about you hitting them, that's kind of a tricky situation. I would just say, you know, we're having a hard time. That's, if it's somebody's ever questioning you about it, and that's something that I would just be honest about.
Yeah.
We're having a hard time. This is not really true. We're just very emotional right now and just kind of speaking along in that sense. But there's no shame in it. It happens.
Yes. No, I remember once somebody knocking on my door at 9:30 at night. We're from child services. We've come to interview your children. I said, no, you haven't. Not at 9:30 at night. Wow. What is this all about? And they said, there's been a complaint about your children screaming. I said, they're 2.5 and 1 and a bit. And they chased each other around screaming. And so they asked me some questions. And I refused to have them wake up my children, a perfect stranger, wake my children up and ask them questions. Absolutely not. And it, and then they asked me who my doctor was. And she said, when did you last see her? And I said, 2 days ago. And they said, case closed. And I go, why suddenly case closed when you've been putting me through the ringer here? And it's because she was one of the leading advocates against child abuse. And so if there was any, she would have reported it. It turned out the guys downstairs were single. And they hear the kids screaming and they automatically assume that we're beating them. Now, on one side, I'm glad that there was a checkup because there are children that get beaten up.
Yeah.
But on the other side is maybe knock on the door yourself and assess things before you go to that extreme, right? Because then you're putting the parent on the spot. And I think it's very difficult for some parents when they fear all this outside thing. It's the same when they go to school and they're maybe even give their anxiety to their child. Now, you're going to behave today, aren't you? Don't you do this? Don't you do that? And then the child goes into the classroom already on eggshells.
Yeah. No, it's very true. Yeah. And, I, you know, oftentimes I've seen, unfortunately, I'm a special education teacher, and I've seen a lot of other teachers, you know, always give parents negative feedback. Oh, he did this today. He did that today. He was screaming. He was crying. They would call home during the day. And I've worked with a lot of parents who truly get anxious whenever they get a call from the school for that reason.
Yes.
And that's not fair.
It's not fair in either the child or the person. And, you know, you've chosen this field of special ed. And I think that all teachers, when they're going through it, should be taught how to, you know, have navigational skills of dealing with any children that aren't quote normal, because it is so mainstream today. You know, we have children that are deaf, children that are blind, children that are this and that. Why can't they be a part of the mainstream? We want them to integrate and feel normal and not, oh, they have to go to a specialty school because they're different, right? And
When I was growing up, this is part of the reason, you know, everything you're saying is so true. When I was growing up, I've always wondered why certain kids would be in one completely different part of the school, you know, completely segregated in a sense from everyone else. And I was always wondering why those kids were alone and always by themselves, always had, you know, more teachers. And I just never understood it. And I never even really saw them.
Right.
They weren't really included in any events, especially in high school. That's where most of my awareness came from. But you're completely right. You know, we should be integrating them and giving them opportunities to integrate with other children and exposing children who are in mainstream classrooms to these types of kids, because then they see them and they're like, who are these kids and why are they so different?
Right.
So having those conversations and that exposure is definitely important. Completely agree.
If you're segregating them, you're saying there's something wrong with those children. And then you're saying to the other children, you're superior. No child is inferior or superior to each other, right? They are just what they are. When you put them all together, you're teaching the children that are more able to be more compassionate and understanding of those that are more difficult. You're also empowering them to step up and be of assistance. Right. And you're creating a buddy system. Now, that is something that then goes with them for the rest of their lives.
Exactly. You know, and right now in today's society, we have such a big problem with bullying and a lot of kids not wanting to come to school, specifically kids who are neurodivergent. And a part of that is because of lack of exposure, lack of opportunities to integrate. And I just think as a special ed teacher, you know, I do teach a special ed class. One of the things that I make a priority is at least one or two times a month, we will integrate with another third grade class, a gen ed third grade class, and we will do a project with them. We'll do an activity. We'll do a lesson, just so, again, they're getting that exposure. Because something more needs to be done outside of specials, because, you know, kids, a lot of times, you know, schools will justify the, you know, segregation in a sense by having, you know, integrating only during specials like gym and art and subjects like that. However, I feel like that's not enough, you know, and it's not enough opportunity to have that social interaction. So I try my best to give it as much as possible. And I think, you know, that's something every school district should
integrate. Oh, got a little freeze here. She'll be back. Hold on, folks. Okay, we had a nice little hiccup there, the dear old internet, which is wonderful. But you were talking about that integration. And, you know, one of the things that I hear, because I have a best friend is a teacher, and she's retired now. But one of the problems was is classrooms getting bigger. And teachers are being demanded more. Instead of somebody else being there as an assistant to help children that are a bit behind, even if they're, quote, differently able, not everybody learns at the same level, right? Or people learn in a different way and they need that kind of little one-on-one. And if there's somebody going around that's kind of helping that child, not making them feel like they were left behind, they just needed a bit more assistance. But we, you know, we're always cutting budgets to the school system. And it's like, you're cutting your nose off to spite your face. Because if you don't invest in your children today and show them all they can be and prepare them for tomorrow, you're back to dysfunction again.
Right. Yeah, that is a very big problem. And I think, again, that that involves teacher training of how to differentiate work and modify work, because teachers don't have the training or knowledge of sometimes on how to change the work for, you know, to modify and accommodate all of their students.
Yeah.
Because not all kids learn at the same level. And specifically after COVID, till this day, I have seen a lot of children, you know, going backwards, kids who were severely delayed because of COVID-19 and having to do remote learning for that year. Sometimes two, you know, I think for some of them, 2 years.
Wow.
But a lot of teachers don't have that knowledge or training on how to differentiate and how to modify work to accommodate all of their learners. And that's something, again, that I learned as a special education teacher, but gen ed classes don't always have that. And also because of their really large class sizes, little staffing, they don't have the time or the resources to do that either.
No. I mean, you may put so much taxation on teachers, and very often they're having to buy their own supplies. And, you know, the money that they get is certainly not enough for what they put in. And, you know, it's just so short-sighted. You'll spend quadro millions on putting in a new president or supporting a new war? How about supporting your children, you know, from the ground up, from conception up, and really show families and children that you really do believe in them because they are your future? And so it's so short-sighted. But, you know, it's, I know that an awful lot of change comes about from parents that did not find resources. And the parents band together, they create associations, they demand government does something to bring about the change. And a lot of changes come around from those roots. How is it for teachers? You know, because you don't want to be ostracized, you don't want to be picked on, but, you know, do teachers feel safe enough to come together and say, this is how we see it needs to change, and this is, you know, what we're pushing for change. Hear us. We're the ones on the front, right? We're on the front lines. Are you doing it? Do you feel safe doing it? And is anyone listening?
No. No, it's hard. It's a very, you know, especially because I'm still pretty new, you know, this is my fourth year teaching. I definitely don't feel comfortable, you know, reaching out. I feel comfortable within my own building and my own administration. But it's a harder conversation to have with people who are above, you know, and people who really do make the big changes. And it is a hard conversation. There's times where I do feel supported, and there are times where I don't feel supported. I don't feel like I always have the resources. And again, I just think it's due to lack of staffing, lack of support. There's just so many factors that contribute to it, which is why we have this teacher shortage, and not a lot of people want to be teachers anymore. And a lot of people are leaving the education field. And there was a time where I just didn't understand it. I'm like, how are we, you know, having this big teacher shortage? But then, like, when I started working more and seeing more and gaining more experience, I could understand.
Yeah, exactly. You know, having had three children, and I was a volunteer in the school system. So either in attendance or various other ways or reading or whatever the case was. And, you know, teachers would say, without parents, you know, support, it would be so much harder. And, you know, as parents, yes, you know, we don't just hand our kids over and forget it, right? It is like, what do the teachers need from us that we can give to support them? Because, you know, I've literally seen a teacher running down the street crying because it was all too much. All right. And I, you know, I don't blame her. I mean,
I've had those things.
Yeah. You know, everybody has a limit, right? Everybody has a limit to what you can take. And if you don't feel supported and, you know, and you always feel like the wind is against you, and then how are you able to give your best to these children?
Right. No, I completely agree. And like I said, there are days where I feel, you know, there's just a lot now that is expected of us where, you know, at the same time, we have to submit all of our lesson plans. We have to also submit, we have to create our lesson plans. We have to prepare for our lessons. And on top of that, we're doing other things. Like we have to write IEPs for special education teachers. We have meetings throughout the day. I'm part of a couple of committees. So there's just so many things that just add up. And sometimes I'm just like, it is all too much.
Yes. Yes. And then you get burnout, and then you're not there for the children. And then we're back into that vicious cycle again. And I just, what I don't get is in today, where there is so much information, a click away, where there is so much evidence of overload or strain, or so much evidence of autistic or any other children with, you know, these differently abledness, of how productive they are, how creative they are, how much they contribute to society in their way, that all that evidence is definitely there. And then it's, why are the politicians not seeing it? Why is the school board not seeing it? Is it that really we're looking at generations that should be kind of retiring because they're still seeing things from when they were in school? And we need newer blood in there that sees things that are happening currently. You know, what would you say is the issue?
It's really hard to say, you know, to say, because there's just so many factors. And again, I just think it goes back to people, you know, who maybe don't fully understand or fully aware of what's really happening because they're not in the classrooms, and lack of exposure, and people are complaining, but there's not a lot of insight onto what's really going on and why teachers are feeling the way they do.
I mean, and I remember during COVID interviewing a doctor, and she said, I have signed more death certificates in this last few months than I have in my entire career. And she said, you're going to see an exodus of doctors and nurses at the end of this because they're burnt out. And a lot of other people seeing the way they were treated also go, I don't want to go into that profession. Or they go into private because it's more supportive. And we're seeing this across the board right now. I'm a baby boomer. We're seeing my generation retire. And one of the problems is we don't see enough people stepping into their shoes. Nurses, doctors, yeah. teachers, you know, anybody that's on those lines of service. And that is because of the lack of support, the lack of right. understanding what they need. And we need to really address this because otherwise we're going to have our forgotten children and there'll be forgotten teachers too if we don't hurry up and do something about it.
Yes. And I feel like, again, the biggest factor from what I've seen just within my experience, a lot of teachers are just struggling with the behaviors
yeah.
and are struggling with how to handle kids with specific behaviors or not knowing what to do, not feeling like they just, you know, there's one kid that's just giving them a hard time every day and they just don't know how to teach and how to get their job done. And I just feel like that's the biggest factor right now.
Yeah.
Where a lot of teachers, you know, feel like they need to leave because they just don't know how to handle it and
yeah.
what to do. Yes. And how to move on from it.
And what you need is maybe not a teacher, but behavioral specialists in the school.
Yeah. Yes. On the board.
But yes. are they then going around? Do you as a teacher, can yeah. you go to that behaviorist and say, I'm having a hard time. Can you come and give me some help? Do
so
they float?
Specifically in my district, we have that. They offer it to us. But in other districts, I do think, you know, they might lack that. And a lot of times too, there's not behavior analysts. There's, again, there's a staffing issue where there is not enough of them either. So, you know, a lot of times you might have one, but they're so busy running around, like you said, that they can't always offer the support that's needed. And they can't always be around when somebody has a question or needs help or doesn't know how to handle a situation.
You know, in my chapter in this book, I thought about what I was going to write and, you know, story stuck with me of a bunch of girls that met online, decided to meet together and then stab someone to death just for the
Wow.
experience. And then we heard, you know, more stabbings going on. This was all kind of coming out of COVID. And it almost felt like they had no connection to anything. And they were just looking for something to stimulate them or to connect them or do something. And it's like, we have so let them down. For them to get to that state where they think the only way they're going to get and have a connection is to do that, we have let them down. And it's like when you've got kids in America and parents in America where their kids are going to school and you don't know if there's going to be a shooting today, that yeah. underlying anxiety has to be there. And the way that it's always brushed off, oh, I feel sorry for the parents, my heart goes out to you, but no, we're not going to do anything about gun control. You know, it must be so very frustrating from a teacher's perspective.
It's a fear. It really yeah. is a fear, you know, because you've just seen it so many times where it's like, could this happen to you?
Yes.
Could this be, you know, a situation that you're in one day? And it's something that we think about and we're prepared for. But it's just, you know, it's scary that this is what it's come to.
Yeah.
Not what it's supposed to be.
I mean, you've got enough stresses on your plate, never mind, you know, that. And then I'm sure many teachers are looking, especially at older kids with behavioral things, you know, could they be, you know, what's going on with them? You know, do they have access to guns? And then everybody's jumping, you know, on that instead of just like teaching the kid or kind of, you know, so there's all those other added pressures, especially in America. And
I do
you know,
think a large component of that, though, is also making it an emphasis in the school districts to talk about social emotional learning
yes.
and teaching those coping skills. Like you said, those group of girls that came together mm-hmm. with a gun, that's just so, you know, I think somewhere along the lines, we were lacking those social emotional teaching
yes.
skills and we don't know how to express our emotions. And that's something that we need to make more of an emphasis on across the board.
I completely agree. I mean, look, the generation that my kids went through, cell phones were just becoming, no texting, no online, none of that stuff, right? Now kids are living on their goddamn phones. They're emojiing, everything has become emoji talk. And it's there isn't even a sentence in there. And because there's no depth to anything, no depth to conversation, no depth to connection, they're constantly right. chasing something. And then you've got, as you said, cyberbullying. I've done quite a few shows on that, where, you know, kids have literally committed suicide because of the cyberbullying or somebody taking a picture of them and sending it out. And that kind of behavior is it's deranged, but why has it got to that level where kids feel it's okay to do that? And yes, we can look at the parents. Yes, we can look at the school system. But I think what we have to do is look at society as a whole. And we're telling these kids they're only popular and they're only valid if they've got so many likes or they put a stupid TikTok out making them sensational. And we're telling them that's the value of them instead of the value of truly who they are from the inside out.
Yeah, no, exactly. And they're lacking that. They're lacking that emotion, the empathy. And I've seen it, you know, I've seen how it was when I grew up. And, you know, I'm still young. But I wasn't part of like the big social media phase, but now how it is nowadays where my own students come in with phones and they all, you know, and it's all TikTok and they're making TikTok videos and who can get the most views. And, you know, I go to Sephora now to grab some beauty products and I see like 10-year-olds there and they've just invaded them. And this is what we're teaching society, that we need makeup. We need all of this to look beautiful. We need social media. Exactly.
Yeah, and that is so far from it. I mean, the big, you know, we talk about this virtually in every show, that what I call societal expectations. If we're trying to live up to societal expectations, which are so fickle and empty, then we are always going to be feeling lack because there's no substance in it. You know, your self-value, your self-love is all from the inside out. It's, you know, you can get approval for something that you've done. That's wonderful. But it's who you are as a person that you need to concentrate on. And if we're teaching our kids that the only validation of who they are is on the outside, then we are losing that depth of children. And I imagine it will get harder and harder to teach kids like that.
Exactly. And you just brought me back to something that, you know, when I was in college, there was this documentary that I listened, that I watched that really stuck with me. And it was about a family of a girl with Down syndrome and how, you know, when she was born, the parents wanted to do a cosmetic surgery to change her features, to make it look like she didn't have Down syndrome. And over the years, that was something that she would do time and time again. They would just keep doing cosmetic surgeries, but it still didn't take away her disability. She was still different. There were things that they need to do. And, you know, one of the conversations that we had after we watched the documentary was, is this really, you know, you kind of look and you're like, wow, how could these parents do it? But it was a conversation of, do you blame the parents? Because this is what society has taught that them, that in order for their child to be successful, in order for their child to have a job, to have a successful future, they can't, you know, their child cannot look like they have a disability. And I had empathy, you know, I ended this conversation with my professor with empathy towards the parents, because this is just what society has become, that they feel they need to do this.
Yeah, this is interesting. I've interviewed so many people on different disabilities, autism, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it's always hard for me to get somebody with, you know, have the Down syndrome child, and it's I don't know why, because when we look at these children, they are such joy. They're so present in the moment. Yes, some of them may have some physical problems and some of them may have, you know, different things that you have to deal with. But there's a wonderful show coming out of, I think it's either New Zealand or Australia, called Down with Love. And it's children with Down syndrome falling in love and dating. And it's so adorable. Oh. It's so wonderful. It's a wonderful thing to watch. But I remember when my daughter found out that she was carrying had Down syndrome, and she obviously initially cried. Obviously, she had the initial moment. It was confirmed actually on her birthday, and her other son was up at 5:30 in the morning, and she's sitting there with her other son kissing her pregnant belly, and she said, "Yeah, I've cried. I've got the tears out, but I'm sure when I'm on the floor playing with my son, I will not see a disability. I will just see my child."
Oh. Right.
And that's really how we need to look at our children. Stop looking at them. Never mind if a child is differently abled. If our children don't meet up to the societal expectations, how many parents that are rich and influential, how we look at these rich kids and think they have everything. Most of the time, the one thing they don't have is love for who they are, right? They're poor on love.
Yes, exactly. And that's taught really early on. You know, what happens in early childhood shapes with, you know, who they become when they're adults. And if they're not feeling that as a child, it'll just, you know, come with them and stick with them and stay with them, but it'll come out in other ways.
always. You know, so many shows I've done where people are going, I've gone back to my inner child to heal my inner child, because my inner child was abandoned or abused or this or that. And, you know, that inner child in there is still looking for approval. Do you love me? Do you love me? And we need to go back to our inner child and say, yes, I love you. I love you for who you are. And there's a beautiful word that I use all the time that I came across a few years ago, or flawsome. Every single one of us has a flaw, or it's kind of what makes us who we are. But you know, the Japanese have a saying, when you break something, they put it back together, say a bowl, they put it back together with gold. I say, if you put yourself back together with love, put the bowl back together with self-love, then fill that cup, that bowl with love, and let it run over. And that sometimes our flaw, our idiosyncrasies, our little things that some people look at imperfect, is what makes us perfectly who we are.
Exactly. Exactly. That's very well said. And I think, again, this should be taught in schools. And we need to put this big emphasis on social emotional learning and loving who we are and why we love who we are and what we love about ourselves. And that's just something that we all need to do better at. And I reflect on myself too, as a teacher, like, how can I, you know, make this more of an emphasis? How can I be better at this? How can I express the social emotional learning more? How can I teach it better? But it is very, very important that we make it more of a priority in our education system.
I know that, you know, I buy the kids books like crazy, and they've been reading since they were in the womb. So, you know, for books are very important. And what I love about children's books, especially today, is we're reading in them, or children are comprehending them at whatever level they're at. But parents are getting a reminder. Parents are getting a reset or a redirect into, you know, something that perhaps they've forgotten along the way. And I think it's really, really, you know, read to your children. Please read to your children, and teach them the love of storytelling and the love of books, because there's so much for them there. But there's so much for you as you're reading the child.
Yes, you're right. It serves as a reminder. I actually never really thought of it that way. Mm-hmm.
Like, there's a book my kids had, I'll Love You Forever. And talking about, you know, I know. And I found it again when we were out in a consignment store with my daughter, and I picked it up. She can't read that book to her kids without bursting into tears.
It's funny. My sister has a baby, and she's reading that story, you know, now to him. And every time she reads it, she bursts into tears.
It is one of those ones that really pulls on the heartstrings. But there's so many, you know, like my son, my grandson, he's just turning 3 this week. And he's got to the point with a story where he can read the story back to you. He's not reading the words. He's not that level. But he's remembering what the story is. And he can turn the page and tell you what's next and what's next and what's next. And is delighted that he can tell you that story. So I think that one of the things we're seeing with parents is they're putting their kids in programs, extracurricular programs, all the time. But where is the time that you are spending with your child? Yes. It's not always about the quantity, but about the quality of time.
Yes. And that's something that I have a conversation with, specifically with, as a BCBA, with some of my older clients, where I tend to see this relation, you know, this really, really troubling relationship between the child and my client and a parent. And, you know, something that I kind of say, where it just becomes so negative, where it's constant fighting, constant, you know, seeking that attention, or in a bad way, and things like that. And something that I kind of have to remind them is, like, why don't you guys do something together and do an activity, go do a paint night, go out to eat together, go watch a movie, do things where you can bond and bring that good energy back. Yes. Because a lot of times with, like, all the negativity, it just gets lost. So that's such a great reminder. It's definitely a good point to bring to parents.
Yeah. I'm moving closer to my daughter and her 2 babies at the end of April. And, you know, I've already said to them, every 2 weeks a date night, I don't care if you're tired or not, you know, your brain will do. And I have the babies overnight. So, which I just did this last weekend, because it was my son-in-law's 40th. And my daughter arranged a surprise party, and it was over in Vancouver. We're on the island. And it was actually a tacky 80s murder mystery party, which they absolutely loved. And so I took both the babies for the night. And obviously I'm not getting that much sleep because I'm older, but it was just, it gave them 24 hours to remember they're adults. And I think, you know, if you don't have grandparents around, when my kids were growing up, I didn't have any family around. I had a girlfriend, and I'll take her kids for a weekend, she'll take mine. And these children are like cousins today, and she's like auntie, and it's, you know, grown up that way. And the thing about it is that we need to be supportive of each other, right? And, you know, volunteer to come into the classroom. Hey, look, you just tell me what to do. If it's just helping somebody over there, helping someone go to the bathroom, I can give you an hour here or an hour there. You know, like step up, because we're putting all the burden on you. Then we're putting all the blame on you if things don't work out right.
And again, you know, going back to what you said, that's such a big problem within parents as that I see as a BCBA, where we're doing parent trainings and there just tends to be this, you know, we're not a team energy where it's like me versus you instead of us versus the problem. And again, I think that's due to like the lack of, you know, spending time with one another, the lack of, you know, losing that momentum, losing that connection that was initially there. And I think that's so important. That's really nice that you did that for your daughter. And it's great that you're going to do that for her that every 2 weeks. I think that's just very important. But specifically for children with disabilities, I feel like parents feel like they can't because they have a hard time finding somebody who can help them. One of my first jobs was actually a respite care provider or special needs babysitter. But they don't have a lot of that anymore. And it's hard to find people that they trust. And I think that's where the problem is.
And you know, this is where family member can step up. I mean, you know, my daughter has, you know, auntie who hasn't married, hasn't got children. She, you know, she's kind of called the auntie mame. She can't wait to introduce them to art galleries and all sorts of things, right? And you know, my son and his fiance, they have a daughter from her marriage. They're about to get married, and they love spending time with them, and you know, each going over to each other's houses and things. And it's like where it used to be in my era, where, as I said, community looked out for each other's kids. I mean, it was like the village raised the kids. It wasn't the burden all on the parents. Over the last 30, 40 years, it's become so much about me, myself, and my own, and I don't trust anyone else. And in that isolation, we've lost that support. And I really do feel we need to get back to the village on so many levels.
Yes, that's a really good point. And again, it's the children that are suffering because they have burnt out parents and their parents need a break, but they can't get a break. That's a really good
It's a
point.
vicious cycle going along. You know, as I said, the reason for putting out this book, and it's book one of the thing, is that, and I called it Our Forgotten Children, because we're forgetting what they need. We're forgetting to look them as those gifted children. I don't care what obstacle they have. We all have challenges. Every single one of us has something we have to deal with in life. Theirs is just more obvious, which means in some ways we have learned to be more directional on how to help them. But then if you have a child that's had trauma, or a child that's got problems at home with the parents, and you know that isn't evident because she doesn't have differently abled, no, she's just dealing with something. How do you wh where does that child go? How does someone help that child?
Exactly. That's a really, really good point. And that's where I think that's such an important message to really bring to attention. And I'm really excited to read your book now. I'm really excited.
No, I'm very proud of it, as you may notice, and I've been unapologetic in promoting it. All the money
But
proceeds
that's
go to,
important.
well, and all the money raised from it goes to, each one of them has an organization they support that either support children or families. And so the money goes to that to support them. But it's mostly to bring about awareness, that if so many people just say, I was unaware of that, well, now you're aware, now you can care. Right?
Yes, now
Don't
you can
brush
do
it under the
something.
rug. You now know, even if it's just a question of start talking about it more in conversations with people, start spreading that awareness out more. The system is broken. We need to get behind the people that need the support to change the system. We're letting our children down. And know that we're in an era that so many children are graduating without being able to read or write. Right?
Yes.
And then where's the job force for them? I mean, you know, where I have one of the women in here is a foster parent. And I remember her giving me the statistics that in the jail system, 70% of the people in there were foster children.
Wow.
That isn't a reflection on the children. That is on the reflection on the system that's let them down. We've got to stop throwing our kids away. We've got to stop disabling our parents. We really have got to pour money into communities, into families, into support, into the children. You put the money and the emphasis on that, we are going to see thriving abundance in the years to come.
Yes.
It's short-sighted,
making parents
isn't it?
Aware of what's available to them and the resources that they can have and what they can do when they are struggling or if their child has a behavior that they can't manage. And that's just so such an important message.
Most parents, when something happens, even if they just have a child that's withdrawn or something's going on in the family, they don't know how to reach their children. It's that paralyzation of not knowing what to do, not knowing how to get information, not knowing whom to speak with. And, you know, you think, but we have an information abundance here, you know, a few clicks away. But the trouble is, what's the URL?
Yes. You know, and oftentimes, you know, kids will go undiagnosed or they'll, you know, have these, they'll be going through these, you know, struggles and challenges, not knowing what's going on because the parent doesn't know what to do or how to take a step forward or is even embarrassed and humiliated to step up and say that I think that there's something going on with my child.
In my time period, I was I had chronic asthma and eczema from the age of two. So I was hospitalized a lot, missed a great deal of schooling because when I got asthma, I got bronchitis and I'd be weeks off school. And I remember going back to school one day and they thought I was a new girl because I'd been gone so long. But
wow.
And then I only found out I was dyslexic, not 100%, but definitely dyslexic enough at the age of 21. And I remember it was, let's just hope she makes a good marriage. She'll never amount to anything, right? Because I left school at 16 with probably maybe a grade 8, if I was lucky, right? So it, I was one of those kind of forgotten children because I didn't learn the way it was being taught. But that didn't mean I was unintelligent. It just meant I wasn't academic.
Such an important message. And we need to teach the way they learn.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I feel like we're struggling.
And not every child is going to be academic, but that doesn't mean they're not creative and they're not intelligent. They just use their intelligence in a different way. We need to recognize that, don't we?
Yes, exactly. It's funny you say that. You know, one of my clients is non-speaking and it was just, it was funny. It was not funny, but there was like, we were sitting downstairs in the picture frame, just plop down and it started swinging back and forth. And he was saying, tick, tock, tick, tock. And I just kind of started thinking about it like, wow, this child took the swinging of the picture frame and made a connection to a clock. And that is just something that I just really opened my eyes because in my head, I'm like, I did not think that he was able to make that connection, but he did. And that was just something I didn't even make a connection for. So you're right. You know, it doesn't always have to be academic, but accepting them in their creative ways and accepting who they are and allowing them to be the person that they are.
You know, you've got America's Got Talent and there is the wonderful kid, Cody, who's blind with autism. But when he gets to a piano, I mean, he, you know, absolutely incredible. And then he started writing his own songs. And then like when he's not playing, he's a goofy kid, you know, laughing away. But put him in front of the piano and he transforms completely. And this is what I say with a lot of autistic children is that they're so utterly gifted in certain areas. And that gives them confidence to kind of embrace other things that they can do. So I think if we could look at all of our children as not being disabilitated, but just differently abled and feed that ableness and don't emphasize that they can't do it that way. Try and understand the way they are comprehending it and help them that way.
Yes. Well, there's this quote that I always have. I have it on my desk. I have it everywhere because it's something that resonates with me so much in my teaching. And it's if the flower does not bloom, you fix the environment in which the flower is in, not the flower itself.
Exactly.
And that's something that I have to read time and time again to just refresh and remind myself that when one of my students or clients are struggling, I have to keep finding different ways of trying to make it work instead of just giving up and just letting it go, or just not thinking that the child is able to, because, you know, I have to try to find different ways to try to get the child to learn instead of, you know, and it's something that I've just, it's always resonated with me.
Very much so. You're going to like the first chapter, Michaela Gaffin Stone. She's all about behavioral patterns. And she used to be a nurse and a teacher. She's really been around a long time. And that is her thing there, of that every behavior is an indication of something. Every behavior can be changed if you know what's causing the root problem, right? You've always got to go down to the root. And very often, a behavior is frustration because they don't know how to articulate or don't know how to understand or don't or feel, you know, that they shouldn't be there. And so we're so quick to blame the surface without looking at the root cause. So you're right. Let's look at the soil, you know, not the flower. Don't blame the flower. Let's look at the soil. And I think it's going to be a long time before we see the system change. And as with everything, unfortunately, very often things have to completely crash and burn for, you know, for the phoenix to rise. And I think that the educational system, you know, in many countries is going that way. And at some point, it's then going to take somebody really innovative to say, scratch it. Let's take what does work. Let's look at what we can make work. And let's look at it in a different way.
Exactly. No, it's exactly what we need to do. And part of, you know, being a BCBA, something that we're always taught to do is to shift our mindset. You know, instead of losing patients right away, maybe we're looking at the why and we're trying to figure out what is causing this, why this is happening. And then we pinpoint the reason. So we talk about what the function of the behavior is. We try to figure out what is causing this. And we try to really, really take it, look deep into what the issue is. And one of the resources that we actually shared is an ABC data chart. And that's kind of what we use to track behaviors and try to find patterns where maybe, you know, Johnny is having every night Johnny has a tantrum or is headbanging at a certain time. Maybe there's a reason for that. Maybe there's something in the room that's upsetting him. Maybe his stomach is bothering him. So trying to find patterns and then responding differently, changing our behavior to accommodate them and redirecting their behavior into something else, or trying to give them the toolbox on how to cope with what they're dealing with.
Exactly. How can you help them until you understand what they're going through? And very often they just cannot articulate it. Considered normal or not normal children, they have a problem with trying to say where the owie is. And we have to really kind of pull back the layers and look at the root cause. And it could be, I mean, I live with a 90-year-old who is still remembering she had polio. So 4 years she was in hospital with polio. And instead of teaching her in hospital, she was thrown back into the school system. And a teacher made her go up to the board to do a mathematical equation. And she said, I can't do this. And of course you can do it. She said, no, I don't know what to do. What are you, an imbecile? Right? And like that, she'd been 4 years out of school. Of course she didn't know. You hadn't taught her. Right? So, and of course she told her dad, and her dad was a worrier. You know, he came along and that teacher got what for? You never call a child an imbecile. Right? And you also, you should know more about what's happened to this child. She also lost a twin sister just before she got polio as well. So, you know, where's the compassion and the understanding? And I think, you know, there's a lot of teachers that go into teaching because they like to lord over others. They like that control factor. And then there are teachers, you know them. And then there are teachers that go in there that want to discover, you know, the children, discover, let them be that flower that blossoms, right? And if, I think it's like a very good question to ask as a teacher, why am I in it? Do I like the authority and bossing everyone around? Because you're going to leave a negative mark along the way. Or is it that you love children and you want to be a part of that soil that enriches their growth?
And speaking for myself, I can't speak for anyone else. You know, when I was a student, when I was five, I lost my dad to cancer. And, you know, this was right in the peak of when I just started school. So I struggled like my entire elementary school, middle school years. I struggled academically. I felt like specifically that, you know, I'm one of five. So, you know, I didn't always get a lot of attention, especially because my mom was a single mom and she was you know, taking care of all of us and helping all of us. And I struggled a lot.
Grieving herself. Right.
Yes. Yes. Of course.
Yeah.
Exactly. So she was taking care of all of us. And there are times where I didn't understand what we were learning. And I just fell really behind in school. And I wasn't getting A's and B's. I was kind of getting C's and D's. And that's just how it was. And it really just started from the because of my foundation.
Yes.
Right when I started school, a bad, you know, incident occurred in my life and a traumatic experience happened. And it just shaped the way that the rest was. So something that I try to be very understanding of when I'm, you know, when I'm teaching is what outside factors could be contributing to why they're having a hard time. Why are they struggling? Am I addressing these issues? Am I addressing these concerns? Am I showing them how to do it? Am I just telling them what to do, or am I showing them how to do it? And that's something we lack a lot as society. We just expect kids to know what to do,
right,
where we're not showing them or teaching them how to do it. And, you know, I taught kindergarten for 2 years. So, you know, we had to teach them how to do everything. You know, yes, the first week of school, we're teaching them and showing them how to put our folder in the bin and how to hang up our backpack, because that's what they need. They need to be shown and taught what to do. But a lot, you know, my experience of losing my dad as a child and struggling throughout school really taught me to be more understanding and aware of situations like that in the students that I work with, because you never really know what goes on at home. We only see one part of this child. We don't know what happens at home.
No, and very often they're too scared or too embarrassed or too delusional to know what's going on. They just know something's going on. You know, I said, I think for me, the asthma was the thing because that held me back, but I lost my dad at 11. I was just beginning to have a relationship with him. And then, you know, off he went. And it does change the way you look at life. And but I've always had a matter of a fact thing to do with death. For me, it's not the end. It's the end of them being here in physical form. The spirit goes on. They've gone home. And I've always had that look. But it's more about us missing them. And, you know, with a child, you kind of adapt quite quickly in many ways. But then it's like later on, you know, when you're getting married, when you have a child, when you got certain accomplishments, you know, you wish they were there. But, you know, everybody grieves in a different way. Everybody feels lost. How many children, you know, are caught in the middle of divorced parents that are using their kids as pawns? You know, how many people are in that divide with, you know, all this division going on? Hate, if you don't agree with me, I hate you. And what does that say to a child? You know, so we have to look at their demographic of what they're growing up in, but then we also have to look at what's the demographic around them socially that they're picking up on, because it is nothing is black and white nowadays. There's so many layers, and we need to spend the time on that, which means you need to have the resources to spend the time.
Exactly. And that's where we're lacking. Yes. And that's where we need to do better. Exactly.
Yes. Well, I'm doing my little bit. These shows in the book, I'm doing my little bit. You know, because I do recognize this. I know how school let me down, and that's eons ago. And I know what I can see with the children today. And just, you go to a restaurant and the family is all on the phone. Nobody's talking to each other. You know, have a nine-year-old stepdaughter. I tried to have a conversation, couldn't get her head out of the tablet. And we also know that if you give the phone or the tablet to the child too young, it is like brainwashing. It damages their learning ability. And yet we're seeing people do that as a babysitter. And so we need to make people aware of that as well. So change doesn't come about unless we educate people on what change is needed.
Yes. Oftentimes I'll see parents that I work with, you know, with kids who have disabilities, immediately go right to the iPad. And I feel like they truly believe that's their only source. And that's the only thing that could help them in the moment. And that's the only thing that'll work. Because there are times where they want to have a peaceful dinner or a peaceful lunch, and they just want to eat on their own and not have to worry about their child screaming and, you know, not being able to sit down, not knowing what they could be doing or some other, you know, ways of handling it, maybe making an activity bin, bringing a backpack full of toys and things that they can have with them that you can play with at a restaurant, things like that. And I feel like, again, it's lacking the resources, lacking the knowledge, lacking the exposure to it.
Yeah. And also I think parents Whereas, you know, they would have other friends who are having children, or the neighborhood would know, and you would ask people. Parents are supposed to know it all now, and so they don't even want to ask each other. And you know, my old kids went to, you know, a mums and tots play group before they went to preschool and school, where I met other mothers and we could talk about things, we could share things that work, that don't work, we could be there to support each other. And especially with COVID, that all seems to have gone. There's so few places like that now. And it's so needed. We need a community where parents can come together and share, because somebody has got a solution to your problem because they've just been through it, right? And that's, don't feel embarrassed that you don't know it all or that you're struggling. Please never feel embarrassed that you're struggling. We do struggle as parents. That's part of being a parent. But please feel free to ask someone and never judge anybody because they don't know or they haven't got the perfect everything. There is no such thing as perfect. Perfect moments in
Exactly.
time, but this idea of perfection is an illusion.
Does not exist.
And the more you chase it, the more you lose yourself.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. I completely agree. And I feel like that's a, you know, one thing that I did, I think like a year and a half ago, at a local community center was it created like a parent disability awareness group. Just kind of like a coffee and sip and drink and things like that, where people can come and just kind of ask questions. So I was leading it, and a bunch of parents came, and they had so many questions. And they're like, "Why don't we do this more often? Like, why don't we do this like every month? Like, we need this kind of
Yes,
thing." Where
yes.
they felt like they were just so confused, and they met other parents, and they felt like, "Okay, wow, I don't feel so bad about myself because at least now, you know, I know that other parents are struggling with the same issues I'm dealing with." Because, you know, like you said, people just kind of tend to be on their own boats, and nobody really wants to help each other anymore. And that was the first time I really got to see, like, wow, these parents really want support and want to have this community, but they just don't know how to get it and what to do and how to bring it to life.
Yeah, my daughter would love that. What has happened now is those support groups have gone online and they talk to
Yes.
each other online. And yes, that's better than nothing. But at the same
Yes.
time, there's nothing better than having a group of people in one room over a cup of coffee and just chatting and getting to know each other on a different level. I feel you go a lot deeper. So, you know,
I agree.
if you're listening to this, folks, and you know, no matter what kind of child you have, make friends with other people with children, and especially if the children are differently abled, and set up once a month this person's place, that person's place, you know, rotate it around, bring your goodies, and let's just be open and talk. How can we support each other? That's so important. And parents and teachers are the ones that bring about the change, because we know administration is slow, very slow to change. So we need to get behind our teachers and what they need. And we need to really make sure that the board is listening and about this change, because it's desperately needing to change. So tell us about this. You've got this token boards, Praise to Build Encouragement PDF, and you also got a Circle Care ABC chart that you're giving
Sure.
away. And also tell us more about the Circle Care services.
So Circle Care, I have to say, I've worked for many agencies before as a therapist and now BCBA. Circle Care has been one of the best experiences that I've had. I've really, really enjoyed working with them. I truly feel supported. And they provide a lot of, you know, trainings and knowledge, and it give you a lot of opportunities to learn, which is really great. So some of the resources that they've shared, so the token board, is something that you can use to help a child if they're having a really hard time with a behavior, to shape a behavior, to motivate them to do something that they're really struggling with doing. You offer tokens every time that they are doing the right thing. You're reinforcing them for the things that they are doing right, to eventually lead to what they're working for, or what they need to get done, or what they want to do. So if a child does not want to do homework, right? But they are, you know, they're struggling to do homework, they're throwing a tantrum, they don't want to do homework. Maybe that's a great opportunity to use the token board, where maybe every time they do a problem, or every time they're sitting nicely, or every couple of minutes, you're just giving them a token for doing the right thing, doing their homework, staying on task. And by the time they earn the 10 tokens, or five or 10 tokens, they can earn the TV time or whatever they wanted to have after. So just to help motivate them and keep them on task. Something that's great about it is you earn it, but you don't take it away.
Right.
So once it's earned, but you never want to take that away because it's something that was earned. Yes. It's like me as a teacher earning my money. And then they're like, oh, here you go. Take it. You know, here it is. Yeah. You never want to take that away. You always want to reinforce them for doing the right thing. Maybe we have to pause if they struggle along the way, but they'll continue to earn and make the right choices. Mm-hmm. So that's the token board. I found it very helpful with a lot of my clients and even my students. I've had to use it a few times and I've seen it become very beneficial. The ABC data chart was something that I mentioned earlier, where if a child is having a hard time or struggling, you know, maybe throughout the day sporadically, it's a great way to track these behaviors. So maybe at 9 o'clock, you know, Sally had a tantrum right before going to school. You'd want to write down. So the A stands for antecedent. So what happens before the behavior occurred? The B is the behavior. What did the behavior look like? And C is the consequence. So not, you know, what the consequence was. Consequent doesn't mean punishment. Right. Consequence is what happened after. Mm-hmm. And then you would also put the time and the setting. So basically the goal in that is you're getting you have a place where you can document where all of these behaviors are occurring. And then you can start to see patterns of, you know, behaviors. Why, you know, is Sally having a hard time every day at 9 o'clock? What's going on? And maybe we can find out that maybe it has something to do with going to school.
Right.
So it's just a great way to really track behaviors, understand, document, and see why this behavior is occurring and finding those patterns. So that's the ABC data chart. Sorry, excuse me.
Okay.
And then the positive praise or document really helps parents give them an opportunity of how to praise children and what to say and how they can say it in a way where it's effective. You know, sometimes just saying good job and not looking at them when they do something right or they're trying, you know, they're excited to show them something, which I've seen a lot, doesn't do it. And it's not enough for kids. So this document really shows parents some different ways of giving positive praise where, you know, being very detailed and direct. So instead of saying nice job, you mm-hmm. can say, I like the way that you're doing this, or I like how you sat and you cleaned up all by yourself. Really great job, you know, adding detail, giving support, you know, telling them what they did right and yes. Adding the detail in what they did right instead of just saying good job, and also looking at them and giving them that acknowledgement mm-hmm. and giving them that encouragement and giving that positive praise, because if they're not getting that, then they're going to want to seek attention in ways that we don't really want.
Exactly. It's an incentive, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. So we always want to give them incentives, something that they want to do because they're getting the right reaction from us.
Exactly. We want to show them that this is what we want and show them that this is the behavior we're looking for. And we want to encourage them to keep doing it.
Mm-hmm. I know that, you know, my grandson's at that age where he likes to push buttons, right? And yeah. get a rise. And so what he gets from grandma is the hairy eyeball. Right. And he looks at me and he tries to go to do it. And I just kind of give him the hair. Mm-hmm. It's like Nana's hairy eyeball. but yeah, sometimes he'll try it and see what happens. And, you know, it's rather like the tantrum. Actually, there's another thing that I read, which I thought was so cute. I loved this. A teacher gave a student who got 2% on their test, right, and gave them a smiley face. And somebody said, why did you give them a smiley face? They failed 98%. No, they succeeded 2%. And next time it might be 4 or 6. And it's like, it's the way we look at it. Do we treat them yes. as a failure? Or we do look at them, you got 2 right. How many more can we get there? And have yes. the incentive, right? So I think that we're so quick to dismiss. How about we encourage?
Right. And that's kind of the message of Circle Care. And that's kind of what we do, where we teach parents and we show, you know, we give services to children, ABA therapy, where we provide we help with these behavior challenges that they might be having at home or in school. And we're providing parents with the resources on how to cope with these and how we can change our language and how we're reacting and what yeah. we're doing to help better the child. Because a lot of times, you know, I'll do parent training with parents and we'll talk about something. And I tell them it's because, you know, well, maybe we're, you know, if we say it this way, we might get a different reaction. If we're providing praise for, you know, throughout the day, we might get a different reaction. And they've come to me several times and like, wow, this actually works. Mm-hmm. We're actually getting a different reaction. A lot of times parents just don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of times it has to do with them adjusting their behavior.
Yeah.
So.
And just because, you know, you get pregnant and you give birth to a child doesn't mean it comes with a manual. I had three children. Although I brought the children up all in a similar way, they were all very different and they're going to react differently. So, you know, we've got to adjust to who your child is. Well, Johnny can do it. Well, it doesn't matter if Johnny can do it. You know, that's Johnny. Yes. What about you? What can you do? Oh, you can do that. And it's, you know, looking at our children in a different way. There is not one size that fits all. They're all beautiful, exactly. Different human beings. And let's look at the gift they are. Hence, this thing is raising our gifted children because they are gifted. They're a gift to us. They're a gift to society. They're a gift to themselves. Let's nurture the gift. And then we will actually see such, I want to see a world, I don't know, I'm 69. I don't know if I'll see it in my lifetime, but I'd like to see a world on the way to where, you know, love, compassion, and kindness is the rule. And that, you know, hate, vengeance, opulence, and greed and power are things that are by the wayside. And I think we're slowly beginning to tip to that way where people more and more want to make the changes. We just need to encourage people. And like even teaching our children, just simply to be kind, to be polite. Now, polite is like, hi, how are you today? Acknowledgement. A smile at somebody, acknowledgement. How are you? Acknowledgement, right? And very often people are walking when nobody sees them, nobody feels them. And a little child saying, hi, how are you? Can make their day. You're teaching your child compassion. You're feeding someone else. Little things we can teach our children, little things. And they will grow bigger and bigger and bigger over time.
And a lot of times, just from what, you know, my experience as a teacher, how I greet my students when they walk in shapes the rest of their day.
Yes.
Like if I come in and I'm like, how are we feeling today? It's so nice to see you. High five, hug, what do we need? It is such a different energy and it provides such like a great start to the day versus when I just let them walk in and just say good morning.
Yeah.
You know, how we acknowledge them, how we appreciate them, and how we show them what they are and what they're worth and who they are is important. And it's funny, the kindness thing that you mentioned, something that I do as a teacher is we do like, when students do things that are kind for each other, they get a little note, like a kindness note that's sent home, basically saying, listing the good thing that they did, and letting their parents know that they should be proud of them because of what they did. And this is how they handled it. And my students get so excited whenever they get these notes, to the point where they're always doing kind things.
Well, again, what a great example to the parents that maybe, you know, are bitching about somebody that cut them off or somebody at work or something else. And in comes your kid. I did a kindness. I got a card. And, you know, like perhaps if you practice a little more kindness, you would feel as exuberant as your child. Right.
Yes.
So we've got to remember we are custodians of our children. We do not own them. We are here to guide and nurture and allow them to be the greatest gift that they are, right? They are a gift to us on loan until they're adults. I mean, they'll always be your kids. My kids are, 35, 39, and 41. So they're all up there. They're still my babies. They will always will be to the day I die. But it's respecting them as a human being. Right. And understanding the responsibility we have as that custodian, but also being open and willing to learn from your children. They're here to ignite the child and the wonderment inside of you that you've let jadedly go, and to ignite that heart and soul in you that, you know, has gone by the wayside. And if you play with your kids in a way that lifts you up, then it just is a beautiful circle of love and laughter.
Exactly. I hope that's a very, very good point. And that's something that we have to kind of take a step back and really think about sometimes. You know, even me as an educator, there are times where I'm like, I don't know everything. I have to learn from them. If I make a mistake, I apologize to them because I also make mistakes, and they need to see that.
Yes.
That I'm human. And, you know, there are times where I do things that are wrong, or I could have did something that could have hurt their feelings, and I need to take accountability and apologize, because that's the behavior that I want to model and show them.
Exactly. And we are the models of our children. We have to show them. And so we, you know, don't expect and demand from your children this behavior if your behavior is over there. The other thing is, don't demand a behavior for your child. Invite a behavior from your child, you know, a behavior that they want to do, that they feel empowered to do. And if a child is differently abled and they do have these, you know, anxiety disorders, understand that certain situations and certain things, they don't know how to articulate. They don't know how to express themselves. They don't know what to do in that situation. And this is where you put that blanket of love around them and help them through it, not the time to reprimand them.
Exactly. That's when they need it the most. And that's when they need the support and they need the love and the comfort. And then we can acknowledge, you know, how we could have changed the way we handled it or showed them a different way. The first thing I do, like, just, you know, with kids who have a hard time with self-regulating, is I teach them different ways to cope, right? Yeah. So maybe we'll make a book about themselves and we'll talk about what we can do when we're angry. So,
I like that.
You know, maybe Johnny has a really hard time when he's angry and he throws really big tantrums and sometimes he throws things. You know, maybe we write a story about Johnny who can do different things when he's angry. So maybe Johnny can get a drink of water. Maybe Johnny can listen to music. Maybe Johnny can grab a snack. Maybe Johnny can go for a walk. Give him, you know, showing different things that we can do in that moment when we're angry and referring back to it when we're having those moments. And that's
empowering them to have a moment where they can come back to themselves and not punishing them for the moment. That's the worst thing you can do, is punish them for that moment. What age group are your children?
So I've worked with, as a BCBA, I've worked with kids between the ages of 3 and 12. So pretty large.
Right. Yes. So have you seen the movie Inside Out?
Yes.
Have you seen the new one yet?
No, not the new one.
Right. The new one, I think, I don't know if it's out yet or coming out, but that's the one with adding anxiety and depression.
Interesting
one, a few years ago, I was interviewing a psychiatrist, and I did pre-interviews then. I do too many interviews to do that now. And I said to her, you've got to see this movie. And she saw the movie. When she came to do the show, she said, thank you. All my clients are going to see this now, because it shows why we have emotions. And it's how not to be emotional over the emotions, to understand where the emotion is coming from, or spend the emotion for the moment and move on. And I'm really glad that they've added anxiety and depression, because that's where we are as a human culture right now. But yeah, it's a good one to have in the school and show the kids and have a conversation.
One of my students really likes it, Inside Out. He'll always reference it. So I'm excited for the new one. That's a really good idea.
Be a great movie, like special movie. And then we're going to talk about the movie. And I think it would be a great one. It'd be interesting to actually see how each child connects to it and what they connect to, because that really, really then becomes a real giveaway of where they're at, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. There's a lot of great movies out there that really help people. So there's a lot of things. Bottom line is, folks, teachers need our support. Parents need support. Administration has got to stop looking at the bottom line and start investing in our children. All of our children, our differently abled children, our able children, everyone as a society. And we need to teach our children that they are worth it and they don't need validation from the outside, that it comes from the inside. And teach them how to manage those behaviors and what serves them and what doesn't serve them. And really understand what we're doing. Are we disserving them or serving them as well? So all of this is very, very important. And thank you once again for taking the route that you've taken, because I know it's difficult. And I know it's challenging. And I know that many people have left it because of that. But thank you for taking it. And long may you reign in this and bring about the changes. So once again, the site and your social media that they can reach you at?
CircleCareServices.com.
And to get hold of you, you're on LinkedIn?
Yes. So Yasmeen Helwani.
So Circle Care Services, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram.
Yes.
And they can all reach you there. And of course, the PDFs that you have given, the targeted praise to build encouragement and the token boards PDF, they're right here on the show page. So all you have to do is put in her lovely name, Yasmeen, and then H-E-L-W-A-N-I, And you will see all that she has to offer there. And thank you so much for being with us today. So much that we've learned, so much we still need to learn. But it's really, really important that we talk about this. So folks, I say have podcast parties, listen to the podcast, and then afterwards a glass of wine, talk about what each one of you got from it and expand the information, expand the conversation. Share this in schools, share this in associations. Please, it's not just to listen and go, that was nice. It's for you to share and expand, because when we expand, we change things that need to change. So thank you so much
for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. Come back anytime. Until next time, folks, remember the change that we seek is within us. Let us be the change that is needed in the world. Bye for now. We hope that you enjoyed the show. There are so many more for you here on selfdiscoverywisdom.com. Just go to the podcast tag at the top there and you will see all the many genres and all 3,000 shows ready for your listening. We are here to serve you, to help you on your journey of life, and we know that through inspiration, it begets invitation. We are supported by you, the listeners, and those that we interview. Anything that you can spare us in donation would be greatly accepted, and we do hope that you enjoy the next show.